In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the continuing crisis in Darfur in the western Sudan. Nobody knows just how many people have died during this two-year conflict. The official estimate of the United Nations is 70,000, but many observers say that that is far, far too low, and it takes into account people who have died from hunger and disease, but not the people who have actually been killed. They say that the actual figure could be four or five times that high. The U.S. State Department last fall said that it believed that this was a case of genocide. The United Nations has been unwilling to go that far, but they have said that it was perhaps one of the greatest, if not the greatest, humanitarian crisis going on in the world at the moment. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll try to find out what has been happening in Sudan as we talk with John Heffernan from the group Physicians for Human Rights. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's now led two human rights investigations to the Darfur region of Sudan, one of them in May of 2004 and most recently in January of this year. Going back a little bit, he helped establish and manage, as the executive director, the Washington-based Coalition for International Justice. This was a non-governmental organization that was set up to support the international war crimes tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and also for Rwanda. He was country director for the International Rescue Committee's program in the former Yugoslavia, and he directed efforts to help victims of war from Bosnia and Croatia. He also established the United States Refugee Resettlement Office in Zagreb, Croatia. He has a master's degree from the Columbia University School of International Public Affairs. He makes his home in Washington. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. We just ask people who call into the show to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Heffernan, hello. Mr. Heffernan.
Yes.
I'm sorry. For a moment there, we didn't have you up. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Maybe you just take a moment to talk a little bit about the organization, Physicians for Human Rights.
Absolutely. Okay.
Tell us about what is this organization all about?
Well, Physicians for Human Rights is based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's been around for about 25 years. A number of doctors 25, 30 years ago were concerned about the fact that in a number of places around the world there was poor access to health care. So they formed this organization to really promote health by protecting human rights.
Very good. Specifically now on Darfur, and
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. The piano's loud.
we're maybe just having a little bit of problem here. Maybe we've got a couple wires crossed. You should not be hearing any piano. That must
it's gone now.
Okay, that must have been.
Although it was nice.
That must have been a little bit of our You got a little bit of a taste of what was going on our FM station, probably.
I see. Okay.
Well, all right. Now, again, thanks very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Darfur, now, we have had a couple of conversations about this over the past few months, perhaps, on the program, and I guess I always feel that the place to start is actually to ask some very, very basic questions, because I think that even though it's gotten a good deal of coverage, that I think probably a lot of people have no idea what this is all about. People may know that there has been a long-running conflict in Sudan between the north and the south, and it does seem to have religious dimensions, and partly it just seems to be conflict over who's going to control the country's resources. That seems to have been settled, but at the same time, as that seems to have been settling down, the Darfur crisis seems to have grown, and it seems in some ways to have some of the same dimensions, and yet it's different. What really is this about?
Well, I think it's most important to sort of discuss at first just what we're dealing with in terms of the region. Sudan itself is the largest country in Africa, and Darfur, geographically, the area of Darfur, which is in the west, that borders Chad and a number of other countries in the west, is the size of Texas and or France. So it's a huge, huge swath of land. Typically or traditionally, the people of Darfur who are either of Arab descent or non-Arab descent, non-Arab being from three primary tribes, the Gawa, Mazalit, and Fur, have been marginalized from the government of Khartoum, whereby they have not had the type of political representation that other areas of Sudan have had in the capital. And so there has been a lot of tension in this region for many, many years, not only between Darfur and the capital, but also among people in Darfur. The non-Arabs are typically farmers, whereas the Arabs are herders. So there are land resource issues that have caused tension in the past as well. A few years ago, when the north-south conflict that you mentioned was coming to a negotiated peace, and in fact, recently there was a settlement, and we're hoping that, in fact, that will stick. The people from Darfur felt that they would not be including in a type of power-sharing mechanism, and again, that they would be ostracized like they have been historically. So a number of opposition groups to the government took up arms, two particular rebel groups, and there was a skirmish where people were killed, and the Sudanese government and their proxy forces referred to as the Janjaweed, and this was in February of 2003, responded in a disproportionate way to the rebel attacks, and are still continuing today, where estimates indicate that over 300,000 people have died from either violence and or death or disease. Over 2 million people have been internally displaced, have been forced from their homes and are living in camp situations, and then over 200,000 people have actually fled the country and are now living in Chad in refugee camps.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it correct to say that as far as the Sudanese government is concerned, they see this as an anti-government insurgency, and that on the other hand, the people who are fighting against the government in Darfur believe that they were almost forced to take up arms, in a sense, to fight for their rights within the country?
I think that's accurate. As I said, there has been tension for a long time, and when the Sudanese government came in to quash the rebellion movement, they employed proxy forces, proxy militias, as I mentioned before, called what has sort of been called the Janjaweed, in an effort to quash that. But I think the problem was that most of their forces were otherwise engaged in the south, and so they relied on these sort of mercenary forces that have gone somewhat awry, and in a sense they've opened up a can of worms and created a monster, so to speak, where in fact they cannot control the proxy forces that are continuing to cause destruction and kill people in the Darfur area.
Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't have the religious dimension that the North-South conflict does, because here all of the people are Muslim, but it does have an ethnic dimension. Is that important?
Yes, it is important. It's not religious, and it is more ethnic than anything else, and I think probably the best way to distinguish between the two groups is linguistically. The tribal groups, the black African groups or non-Arabs, I don't like to refer them as black African because in fact they're all African here, but they do have their own culture and they do have their own language. Many people do speak Arabic, particularly the educated people. But the best way to distinguish this kind of ethnic tribal conflict is probably by language.
Last fall, the State Department, and I think this was when Mr. Powell was still the Secretary of State, he said very directly that he felt, and the United States felt, that there was genocide going on here. And the United Nations has said, well, we think this is really bad, but we don't want to use that word. Does that really matter whether you come right out and say that's what this is?
Well, you know, I think it does matter. On the one hand, it doesn't matter because a lot of bad things are happening. Atrocities are being committed, and call it genocide, call it crimes against humanity, call it whatever you want. These need to stop. But what matters about it is that once you do call it genocide, according to the Genocide Convention. If, in fact, you are a signatory and you do deem it or determine it to be genocide, then you're obligated to act to prevent. Unfortunately, regrettably, the convention is a bit vague in terms of what it means to actually act to prevent. We, in fact, welcomed the determination by the U.S. government, which was based on 1,100 interviews conducted by a number of people in Chad who spoke with refugees and took eyewitness testimony, because we concluded this as well back in May prior to the State Department investigation, where I led an investigation with a colleague of mine, and we spoke to dozens of people along the border, refugees, asked them what had happened to them, and came up with the conclusion, in fact, that there was an organized attempt to obliterate or annihilate a particular group of people, and we based it on a series of what we called indicators of genocide that included a consistent pattern of attacks on villages, a consistent pattern of destruction of villages, a consistent pattern of systematic rape of women, which has been an enormous problem. And the other one that we actually decided to follow up on, the other piece of evidence or line of evidence, is the consistent pattern of destruction of livelihoods and means of survival, whereby everything has been destroyed, forcing these people, expelling these people into inhospitable territory, making it impossible for them to survive without some sort of outside assistance. The livelihood indicator, what is referred to in the Genocide Convention as the destruction of conditions of life, is something that we felt was underreported and unexplored in a sense in terms of Darfur, and that's why we went back 2 weeks ago. I returned about 2 weeks ago after a three-week investigation to really look at how livelihoods had been destroyed, what happened to the crops, what happened to the livestock, what happened to the animals, or what happened to the community structure, and also what would enable people to go back, given that these livelihoods have been destroyed.
Hmm. Maybe I should introduce again our guest for this first hour of Focus 580. John Heffernan is Senior Communications Associate with the group Physicians for Human Rights, and we're talking about Darfur. He's led two investigations into the Darfur region, one of them in May 2004, and then most recently in January of this year. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you can talk a little bit more about what it is that you saw when you were there, particularly in this most recent visit where you were there in January.
Sure. As I said, we went to Chad, where there are about 215,000 refugees. Most of them are currently housed in camps. When I was there 6 months ago, a number of them were not, and this was a real concern of ours. In one particular area in northern Chad, we arrived after driving 8 or 9 hours through the desert in very, very bleak conditions to find between 18 and 20,000 people huddled around poor excuses for trees, trying to seek some type of refuge from the incredibly intense heat and wind. And they were getting their source of water was the same source of water that their animals were using. It was ripe for the disease, and in fact, people were dying. Fortunately, 6 months later, when we returned, most of these people, the majority, if not all of them, had found some sort of refuge in refugee camps. It turns out that a good number of these people were from a town called Farawiya, which is in northern Darfur, a town that formerly had between 10 and 13,000 inhabitants, and today it's a virtual ghost town. What we thought was important was to really look at how their livelihoods had been destroyed and to try to take Farawiya as a case study. So we went to the refugee camp where most of these people have settled. A good number of them, probably 8 to 10,000, are currently housed there, and spoke with a number of people about what their lives were like before, what they did, how they survived, and then what happened to them, and again, what would enable them to go back. It was clear to us, based upon these interviews, that most of these people are farmers, that that there was a, in effect, in the town of Ferrowea, a thriving community that was productive and intensely interdependent, that there were family structures and extended family structures and villagers that had lived there for generations that really depended on one another. And their incomplete conditions of life had been destroyed over an eight-month period when the government of Sudan and its proxy forces first conducted aerial bombardment on, almost on a daily basis, targeting animals, of which something like 40 to 50% were killed by bombings. I can't emphasize enough just how livestock plays such a huge role. It's the basis of wealth. It's their foundation. People pay for things by you know, with camels or cows. I spoke to a 76-year-old man in the refugee camp who had had two operations, or at least one of the operations was paid for with one camel and 20 goats. So once these things are destroyed, it makes it almost impossible for them to survive.
Going back to that point that I discussed at the beginning when I was just giving the very, very general introduction about the number of people who have been killed, apparently the World Health Organization, the UN World Health Organization, has come up with this estimate of 70,000 people dying of disease and malnutrition just from those causes. And I think that some people think that probably is low, just if you look at disease and malnutrition. Then if you add in the number of people who've been killed as a result of fighting or have been killed by Janjaweed, then the feeling is the number should be much, much higher, but nobody really knows, and the government of the Sudan is not helping because it seems not to be in their interest for there to be an accurate figure. And they've also made it very difficult for organizations like yours and other people who are interested in trying to get into the area to find out what's going on and to talk to people. They've made it apparently next to impossible for that to happen. Do you have some sort of feeling about what kind of numbers we actually are talking about?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, all the numbers right now are estimates, but I do think that the 70,000 figure is a bit low, and it's been one of the reasons why they are estimates is because a lot of the area is virtually inaccessible. In one particular area of western Darfur near El Janina, where I spent some time, I was told by the World Food Program that provides the food for those who have been displaced that a third of their food has to be delivered through airdrops, dropped by airplanes, which, as a result of the fact that there's very little security and they simply can't get to these people, and so that's just an indicator to show you that in fact a lot of what is going on is essentially unknown because of accessibility. But I think a number of people have sort of extrapolated from these various figures and come up with alarming numbers. Certainly 70,000 in itself is alarming, but the figures that I have seen out there range from 70 up to and beyond 300,000. And what's a little bit different about this situation in Darfur versus, let's say, Rwanda, where in a period of 100 days, 800,000 people were killed from violence, and or Bosnia, where 250,000 people were killed over a 2 to 3 year period, again from violence, is here you have people, yes, that have been killed from violence, but a good portion of those have died from disease and or starvation. A friend of mine refers to it as genocide by attrition. So it is a different story. But you know, the figures are important. But we also at Physicians for Human Rights felt that it was important to look at, as I mentioned before, just how people lived and how their lives have been destroyed. Perhaps they haven't died yet, but in order to restore their lives, once this conflict has subsided and then there is some element of security, we feel that it's crucial that some type of restitution is paid for them so that they can move back and restore their livelihoods.
It's my understanding that the Sudanese government has, in an official way, said, we're not responsible for, we don't direct, we're not behind the Janjaweed. At the same time, it seems fairly clear that the Janjaweed are agents of the government, and some people say that the government actually has been in a very direct way aiding them or supporting them. Is there, in fact, incontrovertible evidence that there is this connection between the Janjaweed and the government in Khartoum.
Well, there are reports out there that have not been authenticated. In fact, Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times just wrote a column last week where he mentions that he was handed a piece of paper that essentially says that a directive came down from the government of Khartoum to instigate or initiate this ethnic cleansing or genocide that's happening right now in Darfur. All I know is that based on the testimonies that we took from the refugees and when they told us about how their villages were attacked, they were typically the pattern of attack would first be an aerial bombardment followed by an on-ground assault that would include men coming in on horses and or camels and or Toyota Land Cruisers. And when speaking to these people, they would identify the perpetrators as both Janjaweed working in concert with the government of Sudan, that there would be government of Sudan soldiers there as well. So I think it's, based on our evidence, it's been a real integrated approach. As far as the sort of the smoking gun or the piece of paper that establishes that this has been a government directive, that has not been out there yet. However, there are several reports that something like this does exist.
Well, then I'd certainly have read the same kind of descriptions, and I think that people have said, whatever the Janjaweed are, they don't have an air force, and that it's kind of hard to believe that this would that the planes that would be providing this kind of support or whatever it is that's providing this kind of initial support for the Janjaweed are government. It's government assets, and it's not this malicious asset.
Well, and clearly, and aerial bombardments has been a key part of the destruction. I mean, the one village that we looked at, Farawiya, was destroyed, as I said, for 7 or 8 months by constant, almost daily aerial bombardments. But that's just one of probably, I don't know, an estimate is maybe up to 2,000 villages that have been destroyed by aerial bombardments followed by some type of on-ground assault that ends with a scorched earth policy where they come in and they loot absolutely everything of value and then they burn it. And one particular village that we went to down in southern Darfur, we visited, and there was absolutely nothing there, no existing structure whatsoever. And while we were there, because we were accompanied by the African Union Force, which is the monitoring force there right now, a bunch of young men from across the border, we were about 200 meters from the Chad border, came across because they saw the African Union plane and it said that it afforded them the type of protection that they needed to tell us their story. And they said that not only was their town attacked and completely burned, but 6 months later, it was burned as well, and particularly the crops, again, giving us or confirming what we had suspected all along, that this had been a concerted attempt to really expel people from their land and to destroy their livelihood so that they won't come back.
We are at our midpoint here, and we'll continue our conversation with John Heffernan from Physicians for Human Rights in just a moment. First, though, there's something we must do because it's the first Tuesday of the month. This is a test of the emergency alert system, and this is only a test.
Message was instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
And this is AM 580 WILL Urbana. Focus 580 is the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Let me again introduce our guest. We're talking with John Heffernan. He is the Senior Communications Associate with the human rights organization Physicians for Human Rights. He himself has had extensive experience in the human rights and humanitarian democracy and governments projects in the U.S. and South America, Africa, Europe. He has led two human rights investigations to the Darfur region of Sudan, one in May 2004 and most recently in January of 2005. We have a caller who is waiting, and others who are listening are certainly welcome if you'd like to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to start us off in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I missed part of your program, so perhaps you've touched on this, but this Darfur situation is just one of the reasons I think we should pull out of the UN and start a new institution, because Colin Powell named it a genocide, yet the United Nations has refused to act on it. And now, from what I understand in the news, they are encouraging people to return without an adequate military force to guard their safety. And this definitely seems to enhance the possibility of increased murder and genocide. Your comments, please.
Well, certainly the political reality with the UN right now is such that there are countries on the Security Council, on the UN Security Council, that do not support anything that would in fact offend the government, largely, and I'm speaking specifically of China because they have economic interests there in terms of oil. So Sudan or China would be reluctant to support sanctions, would be reluctant to support what is needed, and that's a real humanitarian intervention force that can protect and save lives. Right now we do have an African Union force, which is a organization in its infancy that could be compared to, let's say, NATO in terms of a regional body that's in Africa to address these types of conflict situations. I think they're doing as much as they can with what they have. They don't have the mandate to protect, but what needs to be done is they need to get their full complement of people there so that, in fact, they can provide the type of deterrence that they have been. I don't think that the UN in this case is supporting to return of refugees if, in fact, first of all, they can't support them if they're unwilling to go, if, in fact, there's not adequate protection. Clearly, the Sudanese government is supporting that, and some people have returned and returned to a situation where there isn't adequate protection and there are security problems.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Has anyone said, let us suppose the United Nations did decide to get involved and send in a peacekeeping force, how many soldiers would be required?
Gosh, the figures vary. Some say, given the fact that the country is so, or that the region is so enormous, that you would need between, 30 or 40,000 troops to keep the peace. What's there right now is minimal. There is a 1,500 person force that's there to protect all of Darfur. I think there's a possibility it may go up to maybe 4,000 or 5,000, and it needs to be a lot more. It's frustrating to talk about the current force there in terms of its lack of mandate, but I do think we need to bolster what's there because, as I said before, the political reality is such that whether it be the UN or just globally, there's not a heck of a lot of support for some type of UN Chapter 7, which would allow for humanitarian intervention in there, and or some type of unilateral intervention, whether it be supported by the U.S. or the U.K. or others. So we have to deal with what we have right there, and we need to support it. We need to give them more logistical, administrative support, funding support, so that they can continue to do what they've been doing.
All right, let's talk with some other callers. Bloomington, Indiana is next. It's line number four. Hello.
Hi. May I express my appreciation for what these doctors are doing to help these poor Sudanese people? I read an article by some Christian missionaries who were flying relief. The specific flight that they talk about is a flight to a place called Aqaba. It's in the Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about they use an airplane called an Antonov. It's a Russian airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's a large enough, and they carried relief supplies. They describe what they landing. They as soon as they cut off the engine, lowered the tail ramp. We walked into suffocating heat, swarms of flies, and the anxious faces of hundreds of people. All were dirty. Some were naked. Many were sick and emaciated. Then they say a United Nations assessment flight had visited a few days ago, but it did nothing to help. So I guess the people who are helping are the private people like you folks.
Well, thank you very much. But actually, you know, the UN has quite a large presence there. And whether it be United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, which is essentially running the refugee situation in Chad, along with partnering with private NGOs that are involved in implementing the management of camps and things like that, the World Food Program are feeding people in Sudan proper in Darfur. So no, they're in a big way. Obviously, they could have even a bigger presence because there are a lot of people to take care of. Over 2 million people have been forced from their homes. But what's important, I think, what you mentioned in terms of people being exposed to suffocating heat and things like that is that, as I mentioned before, this is a bleak terrain. This is an inhospitable area, even though people have lived there for generations. If, in fact, they do lose everything and they lose their homes, they lose access to health care, they lose access to water, which is a huge issue because it's difficult to come by, then you know, they're in dire straits. And so they really need to rely upon outside assistance. And if the outside assistance hadn't come to those 18 or 20,000 people that I mentioned earlier that I saw back in May that had been huddled under these trees, you know, seeking some type of refuge from the heat and the winds, then probably many, many of those people would have died.
Yeah, I you're certainly right. I noticed with interest that our Secretary of State, Colin Powell, the former Secretary of State, was careful. He actually called the situation in Darfur genocide. And the reason that's important is the term genocide triggers certain United Nations obligations, doesn't it? I mean, once somebody has declared the situation to be genocide, they're obliged to start moving in and helping.
Yeah, well, it doesn't actually trigger UN obligations. I mean, other than, you know, certainly it puts the public pressure out there. But it does if, in fact, a country like the U.S., which is a signatory of the Genocide Convention, calls it genocide, then it does trigger the provision that says that they must commit themselves to act to prevent the genocide. I think what's difficult with that determination, which, again, we welcome, is that it can be interpreted in different ways in terms of what it means to act to prevent. The U.S. has done a lot in Sudan, in Darfur, in the south, in the north, and has provided humanitarian assistance probably more than any other country in the world, yet it's not been enough to stop the attacks. And we were, you know, at Physicians for Human Rights have been calling for a humanitarian intervention to stop the attacks. And unfortunately, I think that the U.S. government has not been has said enough in terms of, or done enough in terms of what needs to be done, and that's, again, to save lives. And the only way you're going to save lives is if you have some sort of peacekeeping effort in there that will protect people from these ongoing attacks.
Well, thanks very much for what you're saying, and thank you very much for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks for the
thank
call.
You very much.
Let's continue. We'll talk with someone next in Charleston. This is line one. Hello.
Yes. If it's not too much trouble, could you review again for me, if you did so earlier, I tuned in a little late. The history, I've heard the refugees called rebels, and that government is responding. First response was to that, that they were putting down the rebels, which then these were the folk who are ended up in Darfur. Could you review that a bit, and then I have a comment.
Sure. I think it's important to look at, first of all, Darfur from a historical context, and you know, essentially you're dealing with people who are Arabs and people who are non-Arabs, or people who tribal groups versus Arab groups that have historically been sharing this land for many, many hundreds and hundreds of years, and there has been, you know, certain elements of tension as a result, primarily because the Arabs are herders and nomads, and the non-Arabs are farmers. So there's been land right issues that have been in existence for a long, long time. Secondly, the area, I think largely because of its geographic location, which is far, I can't remember exactly how far from Khartoum, but thousands of miles, Khartoum being the capital. And as a result, the people that have lived in Darfur have been somewhat marginalized from the rest of the country. A couple years ago, when they were negotiating the peace agreement for the North-South conflict, many of the people in Darfur felt that they were not going to be represented properly in the government, particularly the people of tribal descent, of non-Arabs. As a result of that, the opposition groups, and there were two primary rebel groups, did rebel. And there was a skirmish where I don't know how many people exactly, but a number, a handful, a couple dozen people were in fact killed, Government of Sudan representatives. And so the Government of Sudan did come in to quash that rebellion. But this is what's been occurring ever since. It's now been 2.5 years, and over 300,000 people have died as a result of that.
Yes, and my comment is, and thank you for that dissertation, I understand it better now.
Sure.
I was sure that there was some conflict over land, and of course the nomadic peoples and sedentary peoples are always in conflict. Well, you know, it goes clear back to Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that occurs to me now is the events in Lebanon and the condition of that place in 1977. And the events afterward. Now, I just it'll be a religious conflict there, I assume, because of the conservative and the liberal elements like the Sunnis and the Shias. Do you see possibly, instead of stability, it'll become unstable again, like the Ukraine and across, you know, Eastern and Western Europe.
Yeah. Well, obviously, the only, I mean, what needs to be, there has to be a political solution. I mean, first you need to stop the attack. You need to save lives. But then, you know, in terms of the long term, there has to be some sort of political solution where these people can live with one another. It is not a religious conflict, and you know, obviously, I think that's good. I mean, religious conflicts all over the world have taken on incredibly horrific types of situations, and here people have lived together for many, many centuries, and it's going to take a while for them to reconcile, clearly, but you know, I think that if in fact they are given the type of representation that they deserve in the capital, and if they are a part of this power-sharing mechanism that is supposed to expand throughout the entire country, then possibly there will be, you know, peace and stability down the road. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. And one of the things that we believe that needs to be done that will foster this peace and stability is obviously some type of protection force, but also a system of accountability that punishes the perpetrators of
war crimes or crimes against humanity or genocide. And this is why we think it's essential for the UN Security Council to refer these crimes to the International Criminal Court, which has been created to do exactly that, to punish the perpetrator, so that, in fact, you can foster reconciliation and peace and stability down the road.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right,
sure.
Thanks. Let's go to another caller here. This is Champagne, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi. I got a question for you. Perhaps you know that you're called, the radio station that's interviewing you is in Champaign, Illinois, home, or Urbana-Champaign, home of the University of Illinois, a large Big Ten school. Lots of students, and a lot of them are listening to you now, I'm sure. My question is, every couple of years, there is essentially a job fair for Christian missionaries here on campus. But how do you get into your line of work in a secular mode? Do you need to do Peace Corps? What does a student have to do to prepare to do good globally? Is Peace Corps necessary? They'd go to take a junior job in state?
Sure. Well, having been through this, I guess I can speak from experience that it's been a while, but and I think there are plenty secular opportunity as well as faith-based opportunity that are doing very good work around the world in these conflict-type situations. My advice to young people is always, if in fact they do have the resources and they have the wherewithal and the gumption to go to some of these places, it's probably best, if in fact it's relatively safe, to go there and then to volunteer for one of the many organizations that are doing humanitarian work, and it's more than likely that they will be hired down the road. Now, that's a bit of a risky approach. If in fact you can also offer to volunteer in their offices in Washington or New York or wherever they may be, that's a good opportunity too. Typically, in a lot of these situations, the humanitarian organizations of which I used to work for one of the largest, the International Rescue Committee based in New York, are also looking for people who do have technical experience, either doctors or nurses or water engineers.
Agricultural experts.
Sure, sanitation experts, that sort of thing. I am not. I'm a generalist. I have a master's in international affairs. So it was a little bit more difficult for me to get through the door, and I entered in kind of an administrative or management capacity. But once you are in that door, you know, you're in there for good. And there are, you know, unfortunately, regrettably, this is a growth industry. And you know, whether it's doing humanitarian relief in Indonesia or Sri Lanka in terms of providing assistance for the victims of the tsunami, or whether it's dealing with conflict situations. The other, I should also note that you know, there's the sort of the humanitarian relief side of what people do, but there's also human rights. And right now, my job is really to document human rights abuses, which is quite different from providing assistance to those victims. What we do is we go in and we document what has happened to these people, how have their lives been violated, and then we come back to Washington and or New York or wherever the case may be and try to lobby for some type of policy change that, in fact, will have an impact on saving the lives and stopping the violence.
Great, great. Well, on behalf of all the students that were listening and may see this as a career option, I appreciate your comments.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. We do have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit less, in this part of Focus 580. And again, our guest is John Heffernan. He's Senior Communications Associate with the group Physicians for Human Rights. And we're talking here this morning about Darfur and that conflict and what's been going on there over the past couple of years. He's led two human rights investigations to the Darfur region of Sudan, one of them in May 2004. And then most recently in January of 2005. And by the way, if you're interested in finding out more about this organization, Physicians for Human Rights, they do have a website. You can go to www.phrusa.org and find out more about them. Questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Going back to the situation here that we've been talking about, if indeed the Janjaweed started off as being agents of the government of Sudan, even if the government has, in some respect, it's gone beyond them. They've lost control. You would have to say that if we're interested in trying to mediate the conflict or to stop the fighting, that the world would want to find some sort of a way to put pressure on the government of Sudan in Khartoum and say, look, we believe that you, I know you say that you don't have anything to do with it, but we believe that you do. And if we're going to get this settled, then you, the government, should be doing everything that you possibly can to curtail the activities of the Janjaweed. I mean, what sort of levers are there? Are there any levers that the rest of the world can use to bring some pressure to bear on the government of Sudan?
Sure. I think there are plenty of levers. Unfortunately, some of the levers don't work because you're dealing with in terms of the United Nations, the political reality where there are certain UN members that are permanent members of the Security Council in this instance, whether it be Russia or China, that are resistant to supporting the type of leverage that's needed to pressure the Sudanese government to stop the ongoing attacks. For instance, targeted sanctions on the government of Sudan and others responsible for the ongoing attacks. There has been very little support for this in the Security Council by the Chinese, by the Russians, again, I think primarily because of the oil interests there, what is needed there? A peacekeeping force. Certainly, this is not garnered the type of support that's needed there. Another element of deterrence, I think, that can pressure the government of Sudan is what I spoke about earlier, is the creation of the referral of this case to the International Criminal Court, so that in fact people names are named, that they do know who the perpetrators are. There was recently a commission of inquiry report put out by the UN that looked at the atrocities in Sudan, and the report itself did not come up with a genocide determination, which we think is somewhat unfortunate. But on the other hand, if you read the report, it's remarkable in terms of the atrocities that have been committed. But regardless of this report, again, there still isn't the type of support within the Security Council to support what is needed to pressure the government of Sudan, and that is a peacekeeping force, and that is a referral to the International Criminal Court, and that is targeted sanctions.
It seems difficult to understand why it is, given the amount of attention that's been directed toward this and the fact that the State Department says it's genocide, the United Nations has said it's humanitarian crisis, organizations like yours and like Amnesty International and others that are concerned with human rights and international assistance have said this is a serious problem. Just as recently as Sunday, someone who was a spokesperson for Oxfam, who was working in Sudan, said, yes, it's still going on. And it seems that you just have to sort of scratch your head and say, well, what if everyone acknowledges that it's a problem, if NGOs say it's a terrible problem, if governments say it's a terrible problem, why is it that it keeps on going?
Well, this is sort of the age old question here, and it's one that frustrates anybody who's taken an interest in this situation. And Darfur is not only Darfur. I mean, you look at other places around Africa, the Congo, Uganda, where hundreds of thousands of lives are being lost. I think part of it, and we need to be frank about it, this is Africa and the Western countries that probably can provide some type of support and probably can put an end to this, or at least in terms of trying to protect people, are reluctant to do so, perhaps because there's not a heck of a lot of interest at home for this. The other thing in terms of the U.S. is we are clearly engaged in Iraq, and it's taking a lot of our resources away from other types of situations where, in fact, we could be more supportive of humanitarian type of interventions that will stop the attacks and save lives.
Well, I think at about this point that we're going to have to stop. We've used the time. It is a story I think we'll try to continue to follow, and I'm sure the rest of the world's media will do too. If you're interested, again, in finding out more about the organization here that we've been talking about, Physicians for Human Rights, you can go to their website. Our guest, John Heffernan, is Senior Communications Associate with Physicians for Human Rights. Mr. Heffernan, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.